So let's begin. I think by way of introduction, I'd like to tell you a little bit, introduce you first to me. We're going to be together for 15 weeks, and I think it helps for students to know something about the flesh and blood person who's going to be lecturing to you and trying to share ideas and perspectives in the course of the semester. I was born in 1947 in Berkeley, California. My father was in medical school at the time on the GI Bill after World War II. He had been in the Navy during the war and was in medical school. The first year of medical school back then was in Berkeley, where I was born in 1947. When my dad finished his medical training, we moved to Lawrence, Kansas. He became a professor of psychiatry at the University of Kansas Medical School, and my mom a professor of psychology. And I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, which is the town where the University of Kansas is located. I was raised in a super academic family. Both of my parents were professors. Both of my siblings ended up being professors. Both of them ended up married to professors. My wife is not a professor. She's a clinical psychologist. The joke in the family is that the only social mobility is interdepartmental. So I grew up in a very academic family. I knew by about age 10 or 11 that I wanted to be a professor. I mean, when people asked me when I was in middle school, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, a professor. Because it was kind of obvious to me that professors lived a really good life. They spent their days talking and writing and reading, and what could be more fun than that? So I was destined to be a professor and became one. In my senior year in high school, a friend of the family gave me as a Christmas present an application to Harvard. I was going to go to KU, like all my friends. I mean, I was grew up in a campus town, and University of Kansas is a good public school. I just assumed I would go to KU like everybody else did. And literally, it was just this strange decision by a friend of the family who was at that time, I guess, a postdoc or something at maybe a graduate student at Harvard, I don't know. He gave me an application, so I sent it in and got admitted. And so I went to Harvard. Now that was a different era. You know, that's 1964. It's a very different period. There was much less of a sense of competitive urgency that if you were, you know, a bright, intellectual, academically oriented person and you thought you wanted an academic career, nowadays students with that kind of profile would be applying to a dozen top schools and worry excessively about it. I mean, literally it was the case, at least growing up in the Midwest in those days, we just didn't worry about it. I figured things would work out well enough, and that was fine with me. So, but in the end, I went to Harvard. 1964, the student movement was on the rise. The anti-war movement was developing in connection with the Vietnam War. And in the course of my years as an undergraduate and in subsequent events, I became politically quite left-wing and radical, very active in the anti-war movement. I knew I would not serve in the American military for that war. It's not that I'm a pacifist. I understand that there are circumstances in which defense is absolutely necessary. But for me, at least, and people of my generation, in the 1960s, the Vietnam War was a war of aggression. It was unequivocal that we were on the wrong side, and I could not participate. Coming from Kansas, it turned out to be impossible to get a conscientious objector status. The draft boards in Kansas simply didn't issue them. And so I had limited choices. I could become an exile. I had friends who left the country and never returned. I could go to jail for refusing the draft. I was healthy. I didn't have a broken leg at the time, although that wouldn't have done much good once it healed. I was healthy. But there was one other option, which is that you could enroll in a seminary, because if you were studying to be a pastor or a minister or a priest, then you got a religious deferment. 4D was the classification. This, for those of you who don't know the history, this was the period of the draft, where if you were a healthy male, you were drafted into the army. You didn't have any choice. It's not like today, where it's a volunteer military. It was a period of where conscription. So I decided to enroll in a seminary when I graduated from Harvard in 1968, rather than face the military. Now, I don't think of that as I think of it as a moral choice. It's not heroic, of course. The heroic things to do would be to go to jail for one's principles, or perhaps into exile, which friends of mine did. This was a kind of easy way out. Turned out to be quite interesting, going to the seminary. I don't regret it. But that's the choice I made. As you know, various political leaders in recent years, including the current president-elect, had devised other ways to get out of the draft. And that's the way to think about what they did. They got out of the draft, as I did. It turned out that when I graduated from Harvard, I also got a scholarship to study history at Oxford. And so I cooked a deal with my seminary. I stayed enrolled there, but I studied history connected to religion when I went to Oxford. So I studied history at Oxford for 2 years, then returned to the seminary in California. I was intern chaplain at San Quentin Prison for a year as part of my seminary studies, which was an extraordinary experience and resulted in my first book that I wrote. I wrote it jointly with some prisoners and with other sort of activists in the prison reform movement of the era. It's called The Politics of Punishment. And I wrote it, it was published in 1973, just when I was still a student. Well, the draft system changed in 1971. It's shifted from a universal conscription to a lottery, and my lottery number turned out to be a very high number, meaning low probability of being drafted, so I then could go to graduate school in sociology rather than stay in the seminary. I knew I didn't want to be a pastor or a minister. I mean, that wasn't my vocation. Being a professor was what I had to be. And so when it was possible, I then entered graduate school in Berkeley, where I studied for 5 years and then came here. So I've been here now for 40 years. I'm somewhat of a vanishing breed of academic, someone who comes to a place, feels committed to it, builds programs, and doesn't feel the need to constantly move to better or other jobs. In fact, the sociology department at the University of Wisconsin is one of the best in the world. It's ranked number one or two in the United States consistently. If you're interested in sociology and want to major in sociology, there is no better department in which you could major in sociology than here. I had a student a few years ago whose brother was at Yale. They were both majoring in sociology. And the brother at Yale was jealous of the quality of instruction, the closeness of connection to faculty, the opportunities to participate in research that were available here compared to what he had at the highfalutin, expensive Ivy League college, University of Yale. Well, that's sort of my story. I have two grown children, two daughters, who finally, without explicit prodding for me, finally made me a grandfather. I'm a newly minted grandpa. Well, I guess I have two grandchildren, a year and a year and a half old. I found it an extraordinarily interesting experience, as I suppose most grandparents do, at this stage of one's life, to be intimately involved with babies again. And to have that sense of continuity and history and to realize the future that's embodied in these little people who are trying to become full-blown people. They're learning to talk and walk and do all the things that people do. And when you see them and you realize that they'll be around hopefully decades and decades after I'm gone, you're seeing the future in those children. And it's, for me, it's been very powerful and renewed my, if it needed renewing, but it certainly reinforced my commitment to thinking about the world in which we live in terms of how we can make the world a better place to live. Not just, of course, because I care about my own grandchildren, but because I care about everyone's grandchildren. All right, that's a personal introduction. Now an introduction to the course itself. There are three overarching questions that will guide our discussions throughout the semester. What kind of society is this? How does it really work? And in what ways does it need changing, and how can these changes be brought about? What kind of society is a descriptive question. That is, we want to know what kind of society this is. We have to be able to identify its features in contrast to the features of other societies. What kind of society any society is only makes sense when you have a kind of mapping of the way societies vary. So that's one of our concerns. One of our concerns will be to get the facts right, to get a good descriptive account of what sort of society is the United States in the spectrum and of all possible societies that we observe in the world today and in the past. What kind of society is this? How does it really work? Now that's a much more difficult question. What kind of society is a descriptive question? How does it really work requires having theoretical ideas to describe the underlying mechanisms and dynamics that make the society the way it is. The descriptions are what we observe. How does it work tells you what are the processes that produce those descriptions. That's a much more challenging task. That's where we will get into more theoretical ideas drawn from sociology and its related disciplines. There are parts of the course where we'll have to use a certain amount of concepts and theories that come from economics, because one of the things we want to understand is how does our economy work? I think the economy is too important a topic to leave to economists, because I think they get it wrong. But we will nevertheless have to draw on some ideas from economics. How many of you are economics majors or possible economics majors? Well, that's a surprisingly small proportion. Well, you'll be getting a different perspective on the economy from this class than you will from your economics courses. My perspective on the economy will focus on things like inequality and power. The idea of power is almost absent from most economics courses, but you'll see how that works when we get to it. Finally, in what ways does it need changing? This is an ethical and political question. This third task involves coming to terms with your own values, figuring out what your vision and moral standards and principles is for social institutions. How should we judge institutions? Not merely describe and explain them, but on what basis should we judge them? What are the values that you would like to see in a good society? And to what extent does the society in which we live measure up to those values? This is by far the most controversial part of the course. There'll be controversies even on the descriptions, of course. I will describe certain features of inequality, and some people will say, no, the world isn't like that. That's not accurate. Well, if you think a description I provide is not accurate, then the challenge is to provide the data, the information to correct my mistakes. I will certainly make mistakes, by the way. I can guarantee you, no matter how hard I try, there will be errors in the way I describe certain parts of American society. And if you're skeptical of my descriptions, that's the simplest task, come up with an alternative. And then we'll discuss it. We'll figure out which description seemed most accurate. But this third problem really is the most difficult, the most controversial. The question of how can we make the society better, which requires understanding what we mean by better. You know, the question, in what ways does it need changing, implies that you have some standard by which you can define an improvement. What would count as an improvement? Does increasing prosperity count as an improvement? Most people would say yes. Does increasing religiosity count as an improvement? Well, that's something that would be more debated, right? Some people would say that it would be great if people were all deeply religious. Other people would say, no, I would rather live in a society that was more pluralistic, where there were plenty of religious people, but also plenty of people who had other kinds of commitments, other ways in which they found meaning. So pluralism versus religiosity could be a type of issue around which there'd be disagreement over values. The value questions are always tough. And that will be, I think, the part, the aspects of the course where we will get into the most controversy. Because values play such an important role in this course, I think it's important right from the start to try to begin the process of clarifying the values in terms of which we should judge institutions, and in particular for me to lay out my stance on these so you know where I'm coming from. Sometimes professors in classes that do have a strong moral thread that runs through the course try to act as if they themselves don't have values, that they are simply operating from some kind of neutral position as an instructor. I think that's never possible, and that it's much better for you just to have a clear understanding of what my values are, how I understand these issues, so that if you disagree with that, we can have clear-headed discussions of our disagreements rather than me being sneaky behind the scenes and pretending as if I'm not operating from a particular kind of moral position. So that's the issue I'd like to turn to now, the values and perspectives that animate this course. The class is built around five core values. These are all values which I think Americans broadly hold. There are certainly disagreements about them, but I think most Americans, if you said, what do you think? Is freedom, prosperity, efficiency, fairness, and democracy, are these good things or bad things? Do you think a society that has more freedom, more prosperity, more efficiency, more fairness, and more democracy is better or worse than a society with less of these? Well, I think stated in this vague way, and this is very vague because we haven't put content in these ideas, is as kind of placeholders, as words to describe what people care about, most people in the United States would affirm these values. They might affirm others as well, for sure, but these values, in terms of values by which you judge institutions, I think are broadly shared by most Americans. Well, let me explain what I mean by each of these, and then talk about the ways in which there are disagreements, the character of the disagreements over these values. So first, freedom. By the way, all of these, in the first chapter of the book, all of these values are discussed in pretty much the same terms that I'll discuss them here. So you'll, when you do the reading, you'll be able to think more carefully about each of these. First, freedom. Freedom is the idea that people should be able to live their lives to the greatest degree possible as they wish. People should be able to lead their lives as they wish. This means people should be free from coercive restrictions imposed by others. That's the simplest idea. To lead your life as you wish means you shouldn't have to ask permission from others to lead your life the way you want to, and others shouldn't be able to prevent you from leading the life, your life the way you want to. That's the simplest idea. But I think freedom also entails another idea, that people should actually have the ability to put their life plans into practice. That's a bit stronger than just saying you should not be coerced by others, because to have the ability to live your life the way you wish may require resources. And if you're deprived of resources, you're less free. In my view, poverty is an affront to freedom, not just to material well-being. That's freedom. Prosperity. This is the idea that an economy should generate a decent standard of living for most people, not just a privileged elite. You're in a prosperous society when the vast majority of people are living decent lives, living well, not just a select few. Economic efficiency. This is the idea that an economy should generate rational outcomes, effectively balancing costs and benefits in the way resources are used. That's a very general notion of efficiency. It's not a highly technical idea. It's just this general idea that an economy is efficient if it produces rational outcomes, not a lot of waste, not a lot of environmental destruction. It's using resources wisely and balances costs and benefits in an effective way. Fairness. Fairness is the idea that people should be treated justly and that they should have equal opportunity to make something of their lives without unfair privileges or unfair disadvantages. Fairness means equal opportunity. And equal opportunity means that no one should have unfair privilege or unfair disadvantage. Finally, democracy is the idea that our public decisions should reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than powerful elites. Well, those are the values that underlie the course. There are, of course, disagreements over these values. Four kinds of disagreements I think are especially important. First, there are disagreements about precisely what is meant by each of these values. Consider the value of democracy. What do we really mean by democracy? Do we simply mean majority rule? Or does democracy also entail the active involvement of citizens in political participation, public discussions, and decision making? Or take fairness. Is fairness just a question of removing discrimination of various sorts? For example, discrimination based on race or gender or religion. Is that all that we mean by a fair society, is one that has eliminated discrimination? Or does fairness mean that everyone really has an equal opportunity in life, which would require reducing economic disadvantages that some people face? What do we really mean by fairness? And there's disagreements about that. So one way that these values become controversial is not in the use of the word, but rather in the meanings that are attached to the word. Second, people disagree about the actual performance of our institutions with respect to any given value. Conservatives, for example, generally believe that American-style market economy of the American type is a wonderful machine for generating efficient, rational economic outcomes. liberals tend to point to lots of irrationalities, waste, and inefficiencies generated by unregulated markets. Well, that's not a disagreement about the desirability of efficiency. It's a disagreement about the actual performance of unregulated markets with respect to that value. Sometimes these disagreements are really about facts of the matter. For example, if you believe that the side effects of burning fossil fuels is global warming, and that this has potentially catastrophic consequences, then your judgment about how efficient a market economy is would be very different from someone who denies that burning fossil fuels contributes to global warming. So if you deny that fossil fuels contribute to global warming, then an economy that's based on fossil fuels is efficient. It realizes that value of efficiency because fossil fuels are a cheap way of getting energy. If you believe that burning fossil fuels contributes to global warming and global warming is going to produce environmental catastrophe, then a market economy that puts our energy resources into fossil fuels is an irrational economy. It's inefficient. The market is producing inefficient outcomes. But the disagreement here is really not about markets and efficiency. It's really about global warming and fossil fuels. And those are disagreements which can be resolved scientifically. They're not actually disagreements about values. Third, and this is, I think, really important, people disagree about the relative priority of different values. So you can have two people who both are completely share completely the same views about freedom and fairness. They can both believe that fairness means equal opportunity, and freedom means being able to live your life the way you wish. But then you get contexts where there's a conflict between these. Here's an example of a conflict. What should parents be allowed to spend thousands of dollars on SAT prep courses for their children, which clearly gives the children of wealthy parents an unfair advantage in the SAT test? Indeed, the SAT prep courses pride themselves in saying that they can raise your scores by 200 points if you take their prep course. Well, 200 points makes a difference. It makes a difference between getting in or not getting in to certain schools. Now, nobody with a straight face can say it's fair that the children of wealthy kid parents are able to raise their scores on the SAT test by 200 points because their parents can pay for their prep courses, and the parents of a poor child can't. It's clearly not fair, but it does affirm the value of freedom. Parents should be able to do whatever they want to improve the life chances of their children. That's an important value. I believe in that value, that I should do whatever I can to make my children's lives, and now my grandbaby's lives, go as well as possible. And if the circumstances are such that paying for a prep course would help them out, it's pretty hard to say, no, I won't do it because it's unfair. Very tough for any parent to say, I'm not going to do something to help my kid because it's unfair to others. But it is a conflict between two values. It's a conflict between two values. Now, at the level of individual choices, that's one thing. But in terms of our institutions, we can then say, well, with our institutions, we can actually navigate this contradiction. We can say, yes, we want our institutions to do whatever they can to neutralize the unfair advantage that the children of wealthy parents have. Perhaps by using taxes to pay for SAT prep courses for poor children, so that every child can have the same kind of high-quality prep course. But that, of course, would mean raising taxes on the wealthy parents who are using their private funds to provide unfair advantage to their children. And then it becomes a little, I would say, disingenuous for the rich parent to say, this money is mine, how dare you tax me? when they're using their money to give unfair advantage to their children. The kind of, I think, morally appropriate response of a rich parent is to say, yes, you can tax me because that would be a way of giving advantage to others, and I'm still going to use my money to give advantage to my children. Okay, well, that's just to give an illustration of this really difficult question, difficult problem. What do you do when values collide, in which you believe in both values? It's not that you don't believe in fairness. I think most people believe in fairness. Most people believe unfair advantage is an unfair advantage. But it collides with freedom. And as a general thing in the United States, in terms of public policy, there is a tendency to give priority to freedom over fairness. That's one of the hallmarks of our public domain, is that when those two values clash and you got to somehow navigate the difficult matter of how do you live in a world where they clash, freedom trumps fairness. Finally, in terms of how there are disagreements with respect to these values, people differ in how much they think things could be improved. Many people acknowledge, for example, that American democracy falls far short of any reasonable democratic ideal. As we'll see in the part of the course that deals with democracy, by international standards, where there are attempts at creating a democracy score for countries, how democratic are the institutions, the political institutions of different countries, the United States ranks pretty low. You know, we're in the 30s or 40s among countries in the world in terms of how democratic we are. Well, many people recognize that there are democratic deficits in the United States, but they just think that not much can be done to make it better, that efforts to make the country more democratic will simply fail, and in many cases would simply make things worse. This is one of the things we'll be discussing throughout the course. For each of the different institutional clusters that we focus on, when you see a deficit with respect to a value, are there things that can realistically be done that would actually make things better? Or are attempts to make things better doomed to always make things worse? One political stance is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to actually make things better, because the attempts that make things better only end up serving the interests of other elites of one sort or another. Well, we'll discuss that when we get to various parts of the course. Well, where do I stand on these issues? First, on freedom. Compared to most societies in the past and many contemporary ones, people in the United States do have a great deal of individual freedom. So by historical standards, we are a relatively free society. The value of freedom is realized by historical standards to a significant extent. But real freedom is curtailed for many people by large inequalities in material conditions of life, especially by significant levels of poverty in the lives of children. And freedom is also curtailed in the United States, and this will be a less familiar idea, I think, by using our resources disproportionately for private consumption rather than for public goods. Too many private swimming pools, not enough public swimming pools, so to speak, is actually a reduction of freedom for many people, because it denies many people access to the ability to live a way of life in which they learn to swim. I mean, just as a simple example. Prosperity. While many Americans are affluent compared to most of the people in the world, the American economy is far too narrowly focused on a conception of standards of living connected to material consumption, rather than a notion of prosperity connected to the idea of quality of life. True prosperity gives weight to leisure and free time and meaningful time rather than simply income. efficiency. The American market economy is unquestionably highly productive and innovative. That is certainly true. It also generates pervasive irrationalities and inefficiencies because it is not subjected to sufficient social regulation. We will discuss many examples of this in the course of the semester. I think the most obvious is around environmental degradation, but we'll discuss other examples of economic irrationalities that come from under-regulation of markets in the American economy. You can have markets with greater efficiency if those markets are subjected to appropriate regulation. Fairness. While certain oppressive forms of unfairness have certainly declined in the last half century or so, certainly around racial discrimination and gender, and in more recent years around sexuality, we are a fairer society now than we were in the past with respect to those those particular forms of discrimination. There are forms of inequality in the United States which dramatically undercut the value of fairness, particularly inequalities of wealth and income inequality, which generate massively unfair privileges and disadvantages in our society. We have a long way to go before we could describe the United States as a society built around the value of fairness. And finally, democracy. The rules of the game of elections in the United States, especially when combined with the pervasive role of money in politics and money in generating access to the political system, have profoundly undermined American democracy. Undermined it to the point that some democratic theorists now say we've crossed the threshold in which the democratic institutions are purely symbolic rather than real. I don't go that far. I think we still do have a functioning democracy, but it's a functioning democracy that has been greatly weakened, particularly by the role that money plays in the organization of our political life. To push forward these values means to confront the basic institutions of the United States and ask, how can we change them to better realize these values? I believe we must aspire to more than simply tinkering with our social institutions. We must strive for fundamental change. I don't feel, however, that this vision is un-American. In previous years when I've taught this course, there's always been some students who feel that my perspectives are deeply un-American. I just really think that's profoundly wrong. The views that I hold have deep roots in our culture and history. The values of democracy, economic rationality, fairness have been central part of struggles that have marked American history, even while the realization of these values has been crippled or deflected by the role of power, property, and privilege in our society. I'm on the left of the American political spectrum, but this does not mean that I'm rejecting American values. Rather, I believe that the left of the American political spectrum is the political stance that most deeply hopes to realize the promise for humanity and justice that is part of American history and the American dream. Now, I know that there will be many of you who will disagree with what I have to say about this, and that's fine. I know from past experience that there will be some of you who will hate this course. I mean, I'm always a little puzzled why someone who hates it that much stuck with it. In the course evaluations at the end of the semester, there's always a handful of evaluations that are really hostily critical of me. I don't mind people being critical, just the tone, you know, they're denouncing me for my political positions and feel that the course is just a propagandistic political course to impose my ideas on all of you. Well, I hope that that's not the case. I hope that my arguments are well-reasoned and rational and based on careful empirical investigation of the world as it is, but some of you will reject that. I have three basic things to say to those people in the class who I welcome to stay. I mean, I'm not at all eager for anyone to drop out of the class. But there's three things I'd have to say as to why you might want to take this class even if you disagree with much of what I have to say. First, I think it's crucial that an undergraduate education involve a diversity of perspectives and points of view. And I do not think that balance has to be present in every course. I don't think the optimal course is one in which within the course all perspectives are given equal weight. Now, I will, in each topic, present the views that are critical of mine and argue against them. It's not that I don't caricature those views. I give you the best account I can of views that are opposed to mine. But the course is not balanced. I don't give equal time and weight to all perspectives. You have all been deeply exposed to the standard view and defenses of American society, all of you at least who have grown up in the United States. There are many of you who haven't, but for those of you who have, you've all been exposed to the standard views. The course will provide a different perspective, and therefore it's providing balance in the broader picture, even if it's not even-handed in its internal organization. Secondly, there's a difference between organizing a course from a particular perspective and presenting biased or distorted information. To the very best of my ability, every fact and observation I present in this course will be accurate. I do not believe there's any bias that I can discern in the presentation of the descriptive material. That's that first task, the descriptive material on which the rest of the course is based. While I may make mistakes, I try very hard to achieve the highest standards of factual objectivity. This does not mean that my interpretations are beyond criticism. They're certainly not. This is one of the interesting things, I think, what makes sociology exciting as a discipline. It is a lively battleground of ideas and different interpretations. It's not like biochemistry, where there's a single perspective on how molecules work, which you have to learn. No, sociology is a battleground of ideas. I will present what I believe to be the most accurate interpretations that are currently available. Finally, as a reason why you should take the course even if you disagree, for those of you who still strongly object to the perspective I advance, I ask patience and a willingness to try to at least understand my arguments. In the end, I think this will give you a clearer understanding of your own views. You will be a better conservative thinker, a better defender of American institutions as they exist today, a better critic of people who think we need more social regulation, we need a deeper democracy, we need less inequality in order to achieve fairness, and so on. You will be a better critic of those views if you fully understand the arguments that I'll be presenting. And so in the spirit of that clarification of difference, I urge you to stick with the course in spite of our disagreements. Well, we have 10 more minutes. Let me do one more thing. Let me talk about sociology. For how many of you have never taken a sociology course? Okay, great. It's a great privilege to be the first person to get to tell you about sociology as an intellectual domain. When I was 11, 10 or 11, I knew I wanted to be an academic, but I was clueless as to what I wanted to study. I mean, I just knew that's the life I wanted. When I finally was able to apply to graduate school, I had studied all of the social sciences. I knew I wanted to do something that concerned social justice issues and, intellectual work that would deal in the social sciences. But I wasn't sure whether I wanted to study history or political science, economics, sociology. I didn't particularly care about any disciplines, and my training had been very interdisciplinary. I ended up picking sociology because, in a funny way, it's the least disciplinary of all the disciplines. It's the discipline in the social sciences that enables you to ask the most diverse kinds of questions and adopt the tools and techniques and concepts from the widest possible spectrum of intellectual traditions. Nevertheless, there is a kind of core to sociology. And what I want to do is strip down all the complicated disagreements and debates within sociology and give you what I think is a stripped down but accurate view of what makes sociology sociology. What's its pivotal idea? And we can, here's your bumper sticker for the pivotal idea. Rules govern actions. The myriad of actions that we as conscious choosing persons do, engage in, are governed by rules. But, and this is the cool part of the idea, unlike the rules of nature which govern the motions of the planets, the rules which govern our actions are changed and created by the actions themselves. Our activities are rule-governed, but also our activities produce and transform the rules that govern those activities. Get it? Our activities are governed by rules. We're all doing rules here, right? I'm standing up here, lecturing to you. I'm wearing reasonable clothing. You know, I'm not suddenly taking my pants off. That would violate some rules. You're all sitting dutifully taking notes. You're doing this because you've internalized rules. We're all following rules. Throughout the day, everything we do is governed by rules. But, and this is the thing, the rules that govern our actions are shaped by our actions themselves. That's called a recursive relationship. Our actions are governed by rules, but our actions shape the rules that govern our actions. That's what enables the world to change. That's what enables us ultimately to consciously change the rules of the game under which we live our lives. Well, let's break this big idea down into six basic sociological ideas about rules. First, rules are enforced. Something isn't a rule unless it's enforced in some way or another. You go to a job interview and you're badly dressed and you don't get the job. Well, you violated a rule, a particular rule about how you're supposed to behave when you go to a job interview. There are consequences for breaking rules. If you steal from a store and get caught, you get arrested. The enforcement is variable. Some rules are consistently and systematically enforced. Others are loosely and erratically enforced. And when rules are internalized, we enforce them on ourselves. So first point, sociology studies rules that govern our actions. But to count as a rule, there has to be consequences for violating it. Second point, rules come in all sorts of varieties. Among the most important types of rules, if you want to kind of say what are some big categories of rules, are laws and norms. Laws and social norms. Norms include morally weighty principles like telling the truth, but also things like dress codes and rules of civility. Some of these rules are enforced by officials and authorities, others are enforced informally. And as I said, when rules are internalized, we enforce them on ourselves. Rules are heterogeneous. There are many different types of rules, and it's not always obvious which type is most important. We often think, for example, that legally enforced rules about contracts are in which you are, if you break a contract, somebody can sue you in court. That it's the legal rules of contract which are most important in ensuring that contracts are obeyed. But in fact, that's not the case. If it were the case that the main way that contracts were enforced was by enforcing the threat of being sued, we would have a terrible, terribly inefficient economy. Contracts are enforced mostly because people act in good faith. I agree to do something for you, we sign a contract, but the real reason that the contract worked is that we trust each other. We have norms that underlie contracts. That's sociologists call that the non-contractual basis of contract, the moral codes that underlie contract. Rules come in diverse forms. Rules are not neutral. There are winners and losers. Now, this is really important. Many rules benefit some people over others. Some rules impose real harms on others. This idea is obvious in some contexts. Just consider sports. The height of the basketball net is a rule. It gives advantage to some types of players over another. If the net was 25 feet high, it would reduce the advantage of being tall, not increase it. Right? Because dunking would become impossible. It would be impossible to use the advantage of height because you would be so far away from the basket. The rules change in sports all the time and give advantages and disadvantages to different kinds of people. But it's also true in society. And this is one of the major concerns of this course. You know, if you want to ask what's one of the big ideas of this course that's going to run through almost every topic, it's how do the rules of the game in which we live our lives in American society, once we really understand those rules, how do they give advantages and disadvantages to different types of people? Fourth point, rules and power. Rules are backed by power. Social rules tend to be stable when they confer power on the people they benefit. So it's not just that the rules benefit some people at the expense of others. The rules also give people who benefit from the rules power to support the rules. And when there's that lock-in between the relationships between power and the beneficiaries of rules, that tends to make the rules stable. Fifth point, and this is another really big and important idea, inconsistency of rules. The rules that make up society need not be coherent. It doesn't have to function like some perfectly well-engineered, fine-tuned machine. Some rules contradict each other, others. And in general, it's impossible to follow every rule of society. And sometimes this inconsistency of rules become acute. And we live in a period, actually, where there are sharp conflicts of the rules by which we live our lives. This is especially the case, for example, for women in high-powered careers, where the rules that govern gender relationships and the rules that govern career success conflict with each other. And it's a constant source of problem. Which rules do you follow when the rules conflict? When that happens, that's the context in which rules are most likely to change. And that's the final point about rules. Rules change over time. Sometimes they change behind our backs, just as the accumulation of erosion of rules. A lot of the changes in the rules around gender norms and behaviors occurred behind the backs of people. Not that anybody sat down and said, let's change the rules. They just eroded over time. But other times, rules change as the result of conscious strategy. And those are the kinds of changes in rules that we will focus on when we ask, how can we make American society a better place to live? Thanks a lot, and I'll see you on Thursday.